senses into the sunlight, for there are things that I must do. Wish me luck now, I have to leave you. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. With my friends now, up to the city, we're gonna shake the gates of hell. And I will tell them, we will tell them, bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. That our sunlight is not for franchise, I wish the bastards drop down dead. Next time you see me, I may be smiling. Bella ciao, bella ciao, bella ciao, ciao, ciao. I'll be in prison or on the TV.
Purina. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program of science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and related fields of endeavor. My name is Jim Freund. With me this morning, editor Gordon Van Gelder, editor and publisher Gordon Van Gelder. Oh, just stay tuned, okay? Thank you. Good morning and hello, as Simon Lokely would say. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name's Jim Freund. Let me see. I need state of preparedness, right? At the top of the show, so we can get right into other things, move on, I should be doing announcements. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I'm not as prepared as one ought be. So I will do real announcements later, other than I'm pretty sure that a week from tonight, if you regard this as Wednesday night, a week from tonight at the KGB bar, I know one of the readers is Genevieve Valentine. And this means, well, you got to be there. You know, it's a don't miss because she's wonderful. She's got a novel coming out in April, her first novel, just not a novel, Mechanique, as I recall. But she will be here in April to tell you more herself. I have been sending her lots of emails encouraging her just to drop by. Ever since we started the new time slot, I feel like it's really, well, a very different kind of a show than it was. And she and John Joseph Adams came up to talk about his new anthology and wish him a farewell before he left for the West Coast. And he brought her along because she was in his anthology, right? And so they came up, and all they could talk about is how bad Tron Legacy was. And you know, it was a wonderful show. And to have Genevieve Valentine talking about movies anytime mm-hmm. is well worth any radio time I can devote. So, Genevieve, if you hear me, and I know that's possible that you are, you're always welcome. You too, Rick. I know you're listening. Not only because we all know that you're awake at this hour, because one of your editors is here. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Jim.
How's that for a bizarro introduction?
Bizarre. It's up there.
It's up there, yeah. But let's then do it properly. Gordon Van Gelder has been for how long now? The owner, editor, publisher?
Editor since 1997. Owner and publisher since October of 2000.
Of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction, often referred to by people as FNSF. So if you, there was actually a fanzine I once got, which was ESSEF, FNSF.
I think at the MITSF Society, somewhere up in Massachusetts, they got tired of saying that, and I think they just call it Fred or something like that.
Yeah, something like that. I know there was a convention in Northern Connecticut mm-hmm. called Fred. Mm-hmm. And I always approved of that. It was just one of those what will we call it? Yeah. But the FNSF, the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, is one of my favorite places to find fiction. I am a big, big fan, not only of small presses, but of the Digest magazines mm-hmm. that were mostly born in the 50s.
Actually, I think they were mostly born in the 40s.
Well, Digest? As Digests, really?
Yes.
when did FNSF begin?
October 49.
Ah, okay.
And, it followed after Ellery Queen came before that.
Did it now? Yeah. Okay.
You know, they were both Mercury Press publications.
Right.
And, in fact, they wanted to launch FNSF earlier, and they couldn't for mostly post-war reasons, if I remember right.
Hmm. That's interesting. I hadn't realized that. And the first editor of FNSF is Boucher.
Yes.
Yes, Anthony Boucher, who worked for Pacifica Radio.
Actually, he was one of the two founding editors, if you remember.
The other is...
I feel like it's a game show stumper.
Is it J. Francis McComas?
Yes, very good.
Oh, my God. Ding, ding, ding. I got a point there.
And the only reason I bring it up is because he's the mystery man, the forgotten figure in there. Everybody knows Boucher. Everybody loves Boucher. You know, the annual mystery convention is named after him. His imprint is huge. Even people who knew McComas really don't know McComas.
Don't know McComas, yeah.
But
And in the history of the Digest, H.L. Gold and all these people, McComas is not the first person mentioned.
Well, no, he... I was asking around about him a couple last year or somewhere within the last year, and even people who knew him sort of said, yeah, I would call the office, and I'd get McComas, and he'd say, oh, you want to talk to Boucher? Tony's right here. And it's like, they had no substance on McComas.
And is it conceivable that he was largely like a business and money guy as opposed to an editorial?
No, that wasn't it.
Just a theory.
Well, some of it's going to come out soon because I got contacted about a year ago, I guess, by a woman looking for information about him who was the granddaughter of his brother. And she has this whole family saga of how McComas... The McComas boys were split up when they were babies.
Mm.
And Mick, as J. Francis McComas was known, was raised separately and really didn't know this whole family at all. And she spent years tracking him down and didn't know about his science fiction connections at all.
Oh, the deep, dark secrets are coming out, yeah.
But we're running a little piece, her little memoir piece about it in our next issue.
Oh, how wonderful.
And she's got pictures, one picture of him and one of his brother, whose name is Jesse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was poking around trying to find out more about McComas. Bob Silverberg couldn't really say much. Ron Goulart couldn't say much. I talked to a bunch
Both of whom are semi-historians, yeah.
And, you know, Goulart started because of Tony Boucher. You know, he was a student of Boucher's
That's
as a
right.
kid. He and Phil Dick went to the same writing workshop that Boucher taught.
Yeah, well, at the NYRSF, the New York Review of Science Fiction reading premature anniversary that you hosted, Goulart was telling some of those stories.
But even, you know, he couldn't really tell me anything about McComas. I couldn't, Dick Lupoff, who knew McComas' ex-wife pretty well, he couldn't really tell me much about her either, about him either. And so it was really a sort of unexpected treat to hear from McComas' grandniece with all his family history and sort of shed a lot more light on the guy. You know, like I said, he was always sort of, Robin to Tony Boucher's Batman. He was sort of in the background for so much of the time.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and Boucher, of course, being... A person with many pseudonyms and was a radio personality with his opera program, Golden Voices of Opera. He was music director at one of our stations and certainly had a certain amount to say about the early music history of WBAI when BAI was still a commercial station, World Broadcast Associates, Inc. Boucher was on a BAI payroll, apparently, from like 1957 pretty much until his death, which is, what, 62?
No.
Later?
Later. I think it was 68.
See, oh, wow. No, he was not here that late because Bert Searles, of course, took the job that took the seat, as it were.
Yeah.
When I have guests on the show, and I like to tell them that WBAI has a history in science fiction, I start with Boucher, and they go, who? And then like, oh my God, Anthony Boucher. And then Baird Searles, who they don't know as well, but of course he was writing at both Galaxy and later Asimov's, I believe.
Yep.
Film critic at one and book critic of the other, and I never remember which is which.
Well, he was the film critic for FNSF.
Oh, okay. There we go.
Before Harlan.
Yeah, well, long before Harlan.
Yes.
Yeah. Harlan's a newbie. He's only been doing it, what, about 15 years or something?
Well, Harlan, he's still technically our film editor, but he hasn't written a film review in at least 12 years.
He didn't even review Demons with Sharp Teeth?
That would have been a slight conflict.
like that would have stopped him?
That's true.
You wrote an editorial about Demons with Sharp Teeth that I enjoyed a great deal.
I did...
Robert, I'll see you next week.
You bet.
Okay.
Good times.
Very good.
All right.
Au revoir.
I did It was complicated because I'm actually briefly in the film, so I couldn't really review it myself. You know, I get about 3 seconds of screen time.
Yeah. Oh, you've been in the press lately, too.
Yes.
I just happened to read a review at random of the latest Philip K. Dick-induced thing, and there was a rather good article, I thought, in the Washington Post, which I don't recall why specifically I read that one, but I was impressed by it, by the fact that it quoted you and...
John Kessel.
And John Kessel. Yeah, people who, you know, actually would know about this stuff.
Yeah, Lewis Beale wrote the piece, who's... I'd been in touch with him previously. He's a science fiction fan.
Clearly, if he talked to you and Kessel,
And it was, you know, it was a good thorough piece about what Phil Dick's role, or why he's so popular in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I thought the piece turned out well, too.
My show last week, by the way, was basically about his movies. Mm-hmm. And I didn't diss the movies necessarily. I just said, be sure to read the books.
Yeah.
That's all. That's my message to listeners.
Well, I haven't seen this movie, so I have nothing to say about it.
I was surprised that Manola Dargis in the New York Times gave it a very positive review. She didn't just think, okay, whatever. Right. She really liked it. And from what she wrote, I might like it too. So who knows?
Your guess is better than mine.
Okay, just very quickly.
Yeah.
What is your favorite? What are your favorite films? Based on Dick.
Number one is that little French film, Varjo.
Thank you! Yes.
I thought that...
I actually got a copy now.
Uh-huh.
If you don't have one.
No, I don't have one.
Okay, you will. You will.
But I thought that was just such a little gem.
And I will thank DL, whose name I should not say on the air, for providing it. But I will thank DL.
My thanks go out to... Thank you, DL.
Oh, yes. And you actually know DL.
Okay.
But yes, I would definitely put Barjo number one. I will guess. Let's see if you and I are coincide. I will guess that your second favorite would be Animated.
No, actually, I like Blade Runner more than...
You do like Blade Runner more than The Scanner Darkly.
Yes.
Okay.
But I would put The Scanner Darkly third.
Yeah.
I like Scanner Darkly a lot, but Blade Runner is just such an accomplished film on so many levels.
Yeah. I have a very conflicted opinion about it.
I think for a lot of people, it depends on whether you saw it with the voiceover or not.
Well, yeah. I mean, the voiceover really drags it down. The whole Alan Ladd Jr. component of that, where he wanted it to be an homage to his father.
Uh-huh. And I think I've talked to so many people and found that their attitudes about that movie are completely biased, based on whether or not they saw it originally with the voiceover or not.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen... you know, here's the thing about the film. I don't want to get into the whole thing, but I really have a lot of problems with the film, and I'll watch it another 50 times to determine what they are. So you can read everything into that you want.
Right.
It is such a... I have issues with it, and it is yet such a compelling...
Yep.
Piece of cinema.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that says it right there.
Yeah.
Did you by any chance see either of the two plays?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. I think you would really enjoy both of them, actually. These are for listeners. The very second show I did in this time slot, I had on the author-director of the play, Jew Android's Dream of Electric Sheep, and Matt Kressel.
That was Edward Einhorn?
Edward Einhorn, correct. Who's an interesting and neat writer, but he did a wonderful job, on this production.
That's what I heard.
He really did. And I hope there's the opportunity to see it again. And Matt Kressel, who is a huge fan of Blade Runner, who, when you think about it also, he would have been, you know, at that formative age, right, when it came out, which makes a difference.
Yes.
And then I saw the Mabu Mines. Did a fabulous production of Flow My Tears, the Policeman said. I saw that twice.
Yeah, I read about that. I'm just not getting out much these days.
Well, that was years and years ago.
Yeah.
That was 20 years ago.
Okay.
But I'm hoping they'll do it again mm-hmm. because they're doing Peter and Wendy again,
uh-huh.
which I've seen them do it twice. Yeah. They're doing that this coming April.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I know of at least two of your writers who are going. So. And we should get back to your writers and who you... Before FNSF, you were at St. Martin's Press.
For actually 12 years total, I think.
Yeah. Quite a number of years.
Yeah, from 1988 until about October 2000.
And actually rather, at that point, at least in terms of the science fiction industry, an important figure in publishing because St. Martin's Press carries with it a certain authority.
Yeah, I
from my point
right,
of view.
I can't assess the importance, but I know I think I got some good books out when I was there.
Yeah, but you got a lot of good books out from a good imprint,
mm-hmm.
which is, you know, more to the... Because there are a lot of people who've gotten good books out and that, you know, they're sort of buried because they didn't have market force behind them or whatever.
I'm laughing because I think almost every author I worked with would have felt like they were buried at St. Martin's. You can never win.
Yeah, no, those are writers. What can you say?
Well, some of them were right, some of them weren't, I think.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. But it was actually sort of like a real eye-raiser that you made the transition from going to this mm-hmm. rather powerful yeah. position at a major publisher to take over and eventually purchase yeah. a digest magazine. It
was too good to pass up.
Yeah. It was a dream job.
Well, yeah, you know... I'm trying to think of the right analogy, but you know, it's one thing to be able to drive, you know, your parents' big, powerful car. It's another thing to have your own car, even if it's a beat-up jalopy,
mm-hmm.
and be able to do anything you want with it.
Yeah, and if that car has a history of yeah. being a really cool car, which FNSF. really is.
Yeah, it was too good to pass up.
I got a phone call from a board member, a local mm-hmm. board member of WBAI, not long ago, called me at home, and he told me, and he said, I'm here in Park Slope, and I found cartons of the entire series mm-hmm. of these magazines called Fantasy and Science Fiction and Galaxy. Do you want them? and aside from the fact that I and my partner each have our own.
Have a complete run, yeah.
Yeah, you know, so, yeah, I think Barbara's just missing an issue or mm-hmm. two. I have a run. And all that. I thought it was so sweet of him to think of me,
yes.
regardless. Of that, but these are getting back for a moment just to cavil for a moment mm-hmm. to listeners. Well, it's not mine, so I can to praise to listeners. The Digest magazines are the birthplace of stories outside of the small presses today, and the small presses and the webzines. Are very valuable, very good mm-hmm. publishing, very good stuff. But the Digest magazines, to me, were extremely special. There's almost a subgenre of speculative fiction that I would call, you know, Digest magazine fiction. That, you know, I would throw from the older days, people like, you know, Frederick Brown, Robert Bloch, Richard mm-hmm. Matheson... C.M. Kornbluth, great, great short story writers.
Sure, I'm just trying to... there's no doubt about that. And the 50s especially, when, you know, the Digest had... was sort of reigning supreme.
The pulps were fading a little.
Yeah, I'd say...
Or faded.
From 58 until they finally... The last of the pulps actually ran in the 70s, I think.
Wow.
I think it was a romance... Ranch Romances or something like that. Yeah, but it's still running in the 70s.
I think that Stefan Santesson had one. yeah. At the time Hour of the Wolf was already on the air, Stefan Santesson was still editing
yes.
a pulp.
Yep. But, if you look at the 50s, it's curious because Tony Boucher used to sort of yell at his writers and tell them, you can do better than FNSF. You should be submitting to the Slicks. And it, you know, he'd get on Bradbury's back and make him send stuff to Collier's or Saturday Evening Post. Or, you know, those were the Slick markets.
Mm-hmm.
And Boucher considered FNSF sort of this, a step down from that. But then if you look at what...
Strangely.
Yes. But if you look at what he was publishing as a step down...
Yeah.
A lot of it endures better than the stuff that was in the Slicks at the same time.
I would have to go along with that. Not to mention Boucher's writing.
Yeah.
And how much was he selling to the Slicks?
In that period, I don't know. I don't know that he was writing that much.
At all?
No, he was writing some, but not a lot.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because his classic short stories are so wonderful. Yeah. I recommend a collection called The Complete Werewolf.
Yeah. Yes.
That's complete, C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T.
But I think everything in there is in the Complete Boucher that Nesfa put out a few years ago.
Oh, yeah, it would be. It would be. The Nesfa books are always well worth, they're very well, what's the word, curated, edited?
Assembled,
yeah. And aside, so I find the Digest magazines, how many survive now? Three?
There's
you, Asimov's, in science fiction.
In science fiction.
And Analog.
Right, I think it's just us three. There's also Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock.
Which are great magazines.
And there are some other digests around here and there that I'm not calling to mind right now, but those are the main ones, I think,
when it comes to fiction. All of these are masters of the short form.
Yeah.
They will publish serialized novels as well, which sure. They still do.
And other things. You know, Analog is science fiction, science fact.
Right. Yeah. Always has been.
Yes.
But this is the most frequently asked question. The biggest fact on this radio show has always been, I used to read this stuff, or I don't read this stuff, but I like some of what I hear you present on the air. Where do I start? I have two answers for that. The Best of the Year anthologies, whether it's Jonathan Strahm or Ellen Datlow or Gardner Dozois or whoever, those are always good. And Hartwell.
I was going to say, how could you call David Hartwell whoever?
Yes, exactly. And his is among the best of the best, of course. I can try to get out of this by saying, well, Hartwell goes without saying.
Yeah.
Nice try, Jim. That's one source, and the other are the Digest magazines. There are of course also webzines, but they are many, and one has to find over time which ones are good. But the Digest magazines are all good.
We're in a curious state right now because things are always in flux. But in the last couple of years, as publishing on the web has gotten bigger and more diverse, the year's bests have taken on a bigger, more important role because they've been so good at collecting and assembling stuff from
all media.
Yes, and from so many places that are hard to find, or maybe very easy to find if you have an internet browser, but may be hard to, maybe obscure in that very few people have heard of them. They don't promote enough, or run in different circles, or whatever. So the year's best have taken on a really almost prevalent role for a lot of people in that they're the one place you go to every year to see what's come out, but the digests are sort of still the backbone, you know.
Yeah. They are a constant.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, we've all had to change our schedules. We're not coming out every month now, but we're still the sort of steadiest, most consistent source of short fiction.
Mm-hmm. And it's both a good place to find the new masters of the form. Using the word master in its non-gender,
yes,
apolitical form. This is WBAI. We have to classify all these politically charged words. people like, I would, you know, Richard Bowes and the modern masters of the form that are so good, but not necessarily airport books, as George Alec Effinger used to call them, mm-hmm. the books that you would find before you board a plane. And at the same time, finding new writers. And both experimental fiction and solid-based. Yep. Plus articles.
Yes. I think all the fiction editors of the Digest try very hard to balance these things. And I know, you know, at Asimov's, Sheila Williams has been doing a lot to bring in new writers. I'm always looking to balance new writers with, you know, my last issue had stories by Dick Lupoff, Kate Wilhelm, Barry Malzberg, and Bill Pronzini.
Wow.
And so, you know, there was Alan Dean Foster. So there was this lineup of veterans who, all of whom have been publishing since the 60s or 70s.
Dick Lupoff, by the way, used to do a radio show at our sister station at KPFA. Sure.
Yes, a Pacifica station for years.
Yeah, for years and years.
I think he still does stuff over there.
I would like to get a hold of some of those. Maybe you know, put some of those on here. We're sisters, after all, in radio.
I assume he's got them. I know he had a collection of the interviews that I think he had transcribed. I don't know if he published it or not.
Mm. Well, I remember that there was at least the zine of some of his interviews. I've never met him.
Oh,
I've never met him, and yet we are. There was a time where there was Mike Hodel at KPFK, although he was here actually on Hour of the Wolf before he created his show Hour 25. Yep. He was on with Margot Adler when he was news director here. There was contention on Wikipedia that said Hour 25 was the oldest running science fiction show, and I went in there and said, given that Mike started doing his stuff on Hour of the Wolf... I'm afraid I have to, you know, dispute that.
The ever reliable Wikipedia.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's Dick Lupoff, Mike Hodel, myself, and Shockwave at KFAI, which I don't think is still on the air.
I don't know.
But at any rate, it was the Pacifica stations and Dick Lupoff.
Yeah.
And there's of course, that Anthony Boucher connection and all that. I mean, we actually have a bit to be proud of here.
Yes.
So the next time I ask you for money, give something. Will you? Anyway, but we just finished that, although we're already talking about the next. Mm. Oh, let me tell you about the next marathon I'm putting together. Are you ready? The WBAI cookbook. Yes. Okay.
Okay.
Fine. Yeah, that's, you know, I read cookbooks, so I figured I'd try to put one out. Ask Zena Clark for advice. She was a recipes editor for many years.
If you want, I'll give you my recipe for boiled water.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Yes, actually, didn't Alfred Davidson actually have, no, he had Prospector's Coffee. There was a science fiction cookbook edited.
The Out of This World cookbook? Is that the one?
That's the one. And Avram Davidson had Old Prospector's Boot Coffee, which is basically a French press, but made disgustingly. Which doesn't mean that Avram Davidson didn't actually do that from a little what I've heard of his lifestyles. Yeah. It sounds credible. You have put out relatively... I should do a station break, by the way. This is, if you couldn't tell by the level of professionalism, WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio at 99.5 FM and at WBAI.org, streaming if you're listening live, or archive if you're listening in the past to the past. No, listening in the future to the past. That's it. And... this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. With me, Gordon Van Gelder. You've put out relatively few original anthologies.
This is my first.
Exactly. The Mars book, that was collected stories?
Yeah. the fourth planet from the sun.
That was it, yes.
Was a collection of all reprints from FNSF.
Right. Okay. Yeah, thematic collection.
Yes. This book was actually the concept for this book was actually John Oakes's idea, who's the publisher, one of the publishers of OR Books.
That's OAKES.
Yes.
And a fine, what was his imprint before this?
It went through a couple names, but it was Four Walls, Eight Windows.
That was it. Wow. There's an imprint, some of the books of which changed the face of the literature.
Yeah. John's taste leans towards the avant-garde a lot, but he's very, very daring, very good taste, very interested in doing a lot of off-the-wall things. And he was publishing Paul D. Filippo. He was publishing a British writer named Steve Aylett.
Mm-hmm.
Published Cory Doctorow.
Octavio Butler.
No, actually, Octavio may have started with Four Walls, Eight Windows, but she was edited by his partner, Dan Simon.
Maybe so, but they published her, I think.
I think her stuff might entirely have come out from Seven Stories Press, which was Dan Simon's house.
Oh, okay.
I can't remember exactly now when they split it, which books came out from which imprint.
Okay, yeah, who got the children?
Well, I knew Dan got was Octavia's editor.
Okay.
I just don't remember when the books came out.
Right. Okay. But I haven't heard directly from John in many years, but there was certainly a time where if he told me that he was coming out with a book, mm-hmm. and there are a few presses like that, as I said, I'm a strong supporter of small presses, that I would say, okay, that's probably worth my putting on the air.
Yes.
And it never actually failed me because they were always at the very least interesting and worthwhile.
And what he and his partner Colin Robinson are doing with OR Books is this largely political publishing outfit, where it's largely publishing political books. They have published a book called Going Rouge, which was a takeoff on Sarah Palin's memoir.
Mm-hmm.
And they've been doing...
I love the title.
Yes.
I love the title. It has nuances I hadn't thought of. But as it reverberates in my little brain, it goes, ooh, that's cool. Yeah. I like that name.
If you check their website, you can see that they had a lot of fun with that book. It's very obvious. And John and I were talking on the phone, and he said, you know, what do you think about the idea of doing a book of stories on global warming, on climate change? And I said, oh, I like that. There's a lot of possibilities there. And I think I even said right off the top of my head, you mean call it something like Welcome to the Greenhouse? And he said, yeah, that's the idea exactly. So, you know, we sort of from day one, we were right on the same page on that book.
Literal, on the title page.
Yes. Yeah. Which, although we were not in total agreement on the subtitle, but that's a whole other matter.
which is now called Uncorrected Proofs. No.
No, New Science Fiction on Climate Change.
Ah, okay. It's subtitle being actually a super title on this copy here, but yeah, properly a subtitle. Okay.
But the subtitle is fine. We went back and forth on it for a while.
It's descriptive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tells people what it is. So I don't have to tell folks listening right now, this is new science fiction as opposed to reprints on climate change.
At one point we talked about, whereas I think somebody floated the idea of calling it Tales from Beyond the Tipping Point or something like that. And I can't remember now, all the details now, but there were pros and cons to everything we came up with.
He's got a book by one of our alumni, Laura Flanders,
mm-hmm.
at the Tea Party.
Yep.
I used to engineer Laura. And she does a TV show, Grit TV, which is... related to this radio station.
I guess you just surfed over to the website?
Yes. Good guess. Yeah. And I see six titles here offhand. Oh, yeah. Because I haven't scrolled down.
Right.
These are videos.
Well, they do these book trailers now that are, you know, the equivalent of movie trailers for books.
Yes. What do you... Okay, I shouldn't ask you.
What?
Well, what do you think of the effectiveness of book trailers?
Well, I've been asking John that because since I haven't been a book editor for 10 years now, I don't have any way of gauging it.
Because everybody I know, you know, or mostly now young people, are, oh, you have to see my trailer. And I look at those trailers and I go, it's really very nice. I'm so pleased you worked so hard on it. I try to find something nice to say. I'm sorry, because now those same people who are often guests on this show are all going to be glaring at me. I don't get book trailers.
I personally, I'm with you. If I'm going to read a book, I don't make my decision on whether or not I'm going to read the book based on a film, you know, or a bunch of film clips. But that's me. I'm old school.
I'm old, and a print ad is going to go a lot further for me. And also, I'm going to come across a print ad in a magazine that I read.
Well, that's some of the difference. That we're, one of the reasons why these trailers work is that they reach people who aren't reading magazines. They reach they reach people who are spending all day online.
Yeah, but if I'm watching YouTube, am I? Is it going to jump out at me like an ad, or do I have to be somehow looking for it or something?
Somebody
like
sends you a link to it. It's all it's the equivalent of word of mouth.
Exactly.
Online.
So it's sort of. But the point is, it's got one of the same problems doing publicity as Facebook has.
Yes.
Or Twitter. Twitter at least reaches new people, especially if people retweet it. But Facebook, you're only talking to your friends.
Yes.
And so you're preaching to the choir.
Yes.
That's my problem with it. I think to
That's how it's set up.
I think to reach new... I have a certain respect for Twitter, and I found a lot of friends on Facebook. But when I send something out on Facebook, I assume it's to people who already know.
Right.
And I'm just updating them on the latest. When I send something out on Twitter, I actually get new listeners, new... I've gotten new people into the reading series that that you founded. Yeah. We should mention that at some point. But so I, but a book trailer, somebody can put on Twitter, see blah, blah, blah's new trailer. And if I'm a friend of a friend, I'm following somebody I may or may not, I consider Twitter very hit or miss. But I read The New Yorker, for example, and I pick up The New Yorker and I see that Karen Russell, oh, I have to write her back, that Karen Russell, who read for us with Thomas M. Dish at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings about 4 weeks before Tom Blue's brains out. she they were both wonderful, but she was wonderful. And I saw, and I pick up The New Yorker, and I see she's got a new book.
It's her first novel, Swamplandia.
Oh, you know who she is. She's wonderful. Yep. She's wonderful. She's going to be on the show again. But she and I have to set a date. It'll be sometime in April. And but I didn't know about it.
Right.
I knew about it because I saw a very impressive full-page ad in The New Yorker. I would think a full-page ad in The New Yorker would cost that.
It's those aren't cheap.
No, I wouldn't think so. But I also know about certain books like let's shamelessly promote Gordon stuff. I'll see ads in FNSF in Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. That means a lot to me. A book trailer, not so much.
No, but I did ask John Oak specifically about that and how effective are the trailers, and he said it's still hard to gauge, but on the nonfiction books, it does seem to be effective.
Well, that's an interesting point.
And he said it also, when the trailers go out, they really do seem to drive a lot of traffic to the website.
And the website will sell books?
Right. So,
okay.
In terms of publicity, that's a lot of the game nowadays. It's just, you know, since...
because I know, I have little doubt that if I say right now, that on the OR Books website, I'm seeing that there's tweets from Tahrir, and that there's a trailer for that actually right next to Laura Flanders and Gordon Van Gelder's. Yeah. I know that and Douglas Rushkoff, good books here. Yeah, I know that that will get a few BAI listeners because I see there is a like-minded political
yes.
leaning here.
Oh, yeah. A very strong political slant to what OR is doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is why this Greenhouse book was such a good fit for with them.
Yeah. And so tell yeah. us a little bit more about the contents of the book and all. You know, let's help sell the book for us.
Well, I'll tell you a funny anecdote about it. At least I think it's funny. That while I was putting the book together over the summer, somebody, one of the contributors, went on one of the message boards for, I think it was for Asimov, one of the science fiction magazines, and mentioned that he'd just sold a story. Matt Hughes mentioned he'd sold a story to me for the anthology. And someone came on and immediately started trashing me and the book and saying, well, you know it's all going to be these left-wing, tree-hugging fantasies. Come on, admit it. You know it's all this, you know, all this greenhouse propaganda.
Uh-huh.
And I the problem with the computer, you know, with talking on the internet is you can't see someone break out laughing when you...
No, that's why Smiley started.
Yeah.
In zines.
Well, I didn't post Smileys, but I broke out laughing. And I said to this, you know, the book isn't even written yet. I don't know how you can make these assumptions because I can't. But in fact, I'll go on to say, you know, I wanted to say to this guy, you know, I'd leave you with your own prejudices, but I have to add that Matt Hughes just mentioned he sold this story to me. I've read the story. I like it a lot. You know, I'm happy to have bought it. I'm delighted it's in the book. I can't tell you what Matt's politics are from reading the story.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you that he clearly liked galaxy type stories in the 1960s as much as I did, because that's what he sent me. But, you know, does he lean to the left, to the right? I have no idea. He wrote a story about climate change that I find very entertaining.
Yeah. I've always actually had a problem trying to figure out why people assume that an ecological bent, tree-hugging or not, means left-right. I mean, you know, a lot of political conservatives are also conservationists.
Right.
I remember when I worked for the one political organization, not counting WBAI, which I used to think of as an arts organization, and in some ways still is, was the Environmental Action Coalition, which was the over group, even larger than Environmental Action, because it was a coalition that put together the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970.
Yeah.
And I asked, well, why aren't we a coalition? Why don't we have the Sierra Club? They're conservative.
Yeah.
Excuse me. The Sierra Club is one of the best ecologically minded organizations out there. And whoever was running the Sierra Club at that time, I don't know that the organization may or may not have been conservative.
Right.
But I think the director at that time was a conservative and therefore not of the fold.
Right. That's the thing in American politics. I don't know what it's like in other countries, but it's so American politics thrives on divisiveness and this whole two-party, either you're with us or you're against us approach to almost everything. So it really inhibits a lot of bona fide discussion because you listen to the news and the news always has to present two sides. You know, they've got to get... You know, they'll get the quote and then they have to get the quote from the opposite side.
Mm-hmm.
And both sides have to play to their base and to their party or, you know, to their party. And so they pretty much have to toe a line for their little 30-second squib or whatever it's going to be. And so you wind up with...
I'm looking at the clock because I'm enjoying the irony that we're going to be broadcasting Al Jazeera in just a couple of hours. But sorry, go on.
Well, just the point, it winds up becoming like a sports thing. You know, either you're on my team or you're on the other guy's
team.
That's
right. And I just like to go to a good ball game.
Yep.
It's nice if let's root for the home team.
Yep.
But, you know, if I'm in a different city, it's a different home team.
And
yeah, that's...
Yes. And even more, you know,
I like good baseball.
It's not a game, you know. It's policy. You're trying to cover thousands of diverse people, and you can't say, you know, okay, all of you guys, you know, either shirts or skins, you're on this side or that side. That's not how the country's built.
Yeah, exactly. And I've always had a thing, especially when dealing with the politically diverse, and if nothing, yeah. And we once were politically diverse, Bill Buckley started here.
Yes, okay.
But we're now politically diverse in all the schisms of the left, yeah. Or what have you, or people who had different personal favorite mm-hmm. things, and what was mine outside of science fiction, because I mostly worked in the music department yeah. when we had one, or whatever, mine was ecological.
Mm-hmm.
And I based it on simply, you know what, you folks can argue over who owns this piece of turf and what rights you should have on it. And I'd sort of like to make sure that that turf continues yes. to exist,
yes.
that you have a piece yes. of turf over which to mm-hmm. fight.
Right.
And to me, that sort of underlies all politics. The basis of, yeah. you know, can you exist or not?
Yes. Yep.
And so I could never understand the naysaying, the, oh, you just want, you know, you just have a liberal agenda or yeah. a radical agenda or whatever.
It's so multifaceted. So much of it is just picking up what you hear from the radio or TV talking heads, and so many of the big names in both of them thrive on just playing to one base and deliberately trying to alienate the other base, and so people pick that up and spit it out over the internet, and it's easy to do without thinking. So, you know, I have no idea who the guy was who posted immediately calling me a tree hugger or whatever he said. But it's easy to understand how he has
and
it.
And depending on the kind of tree, that could be really painful. If that's.
I just saw that Peter, The Last Unicorn, where there's...
Peter Spiegel.
Yes, but where there is a literal tree hugging scene.
Yes.
And poor Schmendrick doesn't like it.
Right. I remember that. Yeah. Being a big Peter S. Spiegel yes. fan, I must say. And Connor, if you are listening, next time Peter's in New York, Connor, formerly known as Freff
in
Phantom.
Connor Cochran.
Yes, who sort of Peter S. Spiegel's manager. On the very second episode of Hour of the Wolf, I was telling Gordon off the air, not only was the guest Peter S. Spiegel, but he brought his guitar
mm-hmm.
and he sang. And he did so, original songs and folk songs, and I've got to get that tape out of Adler's hands long enough to make MP3s. She wants this as well, mm-hmm. to digitize it
yep.
and make this stuff available. So, the contents, the writers... I mean, this is like, well, it's just a wonderful collection.
Well,
I noticed, by the way, speaking mm-hmm. of WBAI, lefty yeah. tree-hugging types, the preface, even before your piece, Elizabeth yeah. Colbert, who is a favorite guest through the years over various Pacifica stations.
Well, John Oakes was in touch with her. I wasn't, so... Mm-hmm. You know, I read her preface, same as everyone else. It just came in, and I was delighted she liked the book.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of the contributors, I put in a lot of time and effort trying to get a diverse group.
Mm-hmm.
And
is it indeed all tree-hugging? Because I assume some of it is always going to be Cassandra
of course,
style.
With a subject like this.
Yeah.
Where it's tough to, you know, when you're talking about climate change, it's tough to, it's not like zombies or vampires where you've got, you know, some physical monster in your face that's mm-hmm. going to rip you apart if you don't do something. It's a different sort of approach.
Different kind of monster.
Yes.
Really.
And, it's harder to see in most cases.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stories are actually naturalistic. Mm-hmm. You know, there's one story about a woman who's doing a project. I don't think it's with bird calls, but it's birding.
Uh-huh.
And there's another story, Joe Green's Turtle Love, that's about turtles down in Florida. And Brian Aldiss's story is set in a nature preserve in Borneo, I believe.
Hmm. And there's a person, by the way, who's written a lot of ecological
yes.
science fiction, Hothouse, to name but right. one of his many titles.
He was, you know, at the top of my list when I said, oh, you know, who should I talk to about getting stories about climate change?
Duh.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Start with A.
And A is for Brian, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. A is for Brian. Oh, what a good title.
Have
you used that yet?
I stole it. I forget who did it. I think it came out in the 80s. Maybe 90s. It's a tribute to Brian.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I haven't read that. I have to read that. Yeah. Okay, very quick Brian Aldiss story.
Okay.
Alfie Bester, somebody with the reverse initials of Brian Aldiss, lived on 10th Avenue
yep.
and was a party-going kind of individual. And
Bon vivant,
excellent term. And loved WBAI. And Mickey Waldman, one Sunday night, was on the air. She was on Midnight to Five doing her show. And she knew her science fiction and stuff. And Alfie was playing host to Brian Aldiss in New York. Brian was here. And they're out with many, many, many sheets to the wind.
Yeah.
And show up at the church that we used to own, and he's ringing the bell, and Mickey is on the air, and we had an intercom, and she had said, "Who's there?" And she said, Alfie says, referring to Brian Aldiss, "I have got the world's greatest science fiction writer here who wants to come in." And she said, "Oh, you must mean Alfred Bester." And they came in, they did her show. God, I wish I had that air check. Oh.
I think Brian may even have mentioned that story in his the twinkling of an eye in his memoir. I'm sure I've read that
story about how I played his host and took him in a cab and didn't have the money for the cab, so he had to pay for it.
No, he didn't mention that.
I was mortified. I don't want anybody to know that story.
Except today's listeners.
Except today's listeners. Yeah. Exactly. But we'll all keep it secret, won't we? Oh, I forgot about the internet. Anyway. So A is,
like I said,
A is for Brian.
I tried very hard to get a diverse group, and you know, diverse politically, diverse geographically.
You know, we have scientists.
Well, like Greg Benford.
Yeah.
The one area where I feel like I failed utterly, I really wanted to get people outside of the English speaking world.
Mm.
And I put in so much effort at that. I was talking with writers and translators in Russia, Japan, Brazil, France, the Czech Republic, Israel. Nothing came of it, ultimately.
Yeah, because the problem is you're limited by what the translators find.
There's so many different limitations. You know, you've got to get the store, it was working on a pretty fast deadline also. and so I had to worry about the story, the translation, whether the story fit in with the book overall, because the whole theme. I had one story that was perfectly good, sort of a perfectly good take on global warming, but it wasn't really a good story. You know, it was more like almost like a nonfiction treatise.
Mm-hmm.
And
which unfortunately some people, that's what they will do. Which great writer was it who, great mainstream, he said, wiggling his fingers, writer, wrote a book about population explosion called, something like Population Zero.
Paul Ehrlich?
It was Paul Ehrlich.
Yeah.
Who, you know, was really good writer, really good ecologist and all that, but his attempt at science fiction really sucked. Really, you know, it was little more than a political treatise written in fictional form.
Yeah.
And had it been a political treatise, I would have enjoyed it that much more.
Well, that I was That's what I, you know, was the gist of what I was saying to that guy online. I'm not trying to do a book that's a political position paper or a white paper or anything. I'm trying to put together a book of entertaining stories. Oh, yeah. Very nice.
Yeah.
So a lot of the stories, you know, like I said, I still don't know what the author's politics are. But I know that they told a good story on climate change. That's what I was after.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, if it's done by what seems to be a left-leaning press, yep. And you're talking about it on, I wouldn't say that we lean left, I would say sharp turn. You know, your GPS systems have just made a sharp left if you're tuned to WBAI in New York City. And that's all to the good. What our program director, Tony Bates, mm-hmm. likes to call us the only left, which isn't bad. Yep. Which isn't bad. Yeah. It's clever. So, whatever it may be, and this is a message I would like to get across, and clearly mm-hmm. Gordon would yeah. as well. It's about the survival of this thing we're on, the blue marble, as yep. they call it at NASA.
And I was really pleased. A couple of the stories really, really sort of address that directly. I got a story from a writer in Australia named Chris Lawson. And the whole gist of his piece is that he can't stand all those stories where civilization's falling apart. So all the people turn on each other immediately and start ripping each other apart. And he said, yeah. that's just not how it works. And he wrote a story to show how he thinks it does work. It's a really neat little piece.
I got my ARC, thank you very much, only a couple of days ago. So I haven't gotten much beyond the introductions and the yeah. table of contents. But I can tell this is a book I'm going to be spending time with. There's nothing in here I don't want to read. I see David Prill. I see there are a couple of people whose work I don't yet know, yeah. like Pat McEwen, and, who I probably should know.
Well, I don't think she's published a book yet. She's published about half a dozen stories.
Well, that's always good for me, you know, being a short story fan.
Yeah, I think you'll like hers. It's hers is about about lawlessness erupting in the wake of some of civilization's supports collapsing.
Mm-hmm. Which writer was the Australian writer you mentioned?
Chris Lawson.
Oh, that's Chris Lawson. Yeah. Okay, because I'm definitely going to enjoy that premise. Sundown is the yes. story. Yeah. Because, yes, one of the things I have noticed, I don't remember what it was I was watching, mm-hmm. but my partner and I, we were watching some movie and saying, no, in these kinds of instances, it's amazing how much people help each other.
Exactly.
It's amazing
yep.
how people are not trampling over each other, you know, just to get out of the stadium. They are, I have noticed in blackouts, yep. I remember the New York City blackout of 66.
65.
65, which you don't recall
because
you weren't born yet. Right. That I remember how many different people were taking turns directing traffic coming off the bridges. I remember walking around yep. with a microphone, and I did not see looting. I'm sure that it existed, but I was out there
right.
with my microphone, and what I saw were people helping people.
And you were in some tiny isolated area, right? Like Manhattan?
I was.
Yeah.
I was. I was in Midtown Manhattan, yeah. coming from 62nd Street and First mm-hmm. Avenue, and just walking as far as I could walk with mm-hmm. a microphone in hand, coming back to the newsroom, dropping off a finished cassette, mm-hmm. letting them listen to it and find what actuality, and then I went out to gather more sound. And I was using what they called a shotgun microphone, uh-huh. which is a long microphone. Yep. I got stopped by cops all the time because I learned of the existence of something called a zip gun,
mm-hmm.
which those mics resembled.
Okay.
And when the cops, they came up to me and they said, "What have you got there?" I said, "It's a microphone. I'm recording sound." That's yeah. really weird. Let me see that. Cool. You know, it looks like a zip yeah. gun, right? And said, yeah, well, right. he said, maybe you should put a sign on it that says microphone. And they all helped me.
Yeah.
The cops helped me.
Yes.
The cops helped the citizens who were helping people.
Right. No, that's Lawson's point entirely. He said, it's survival positive that way. That's what everybody gets this silly idea that it's everybody's out for themselves. But if you look at it rationally, everybody's going to have a better shot of surviving if they work together.
Yeah.
So why are they going to tear each other apart? That's just Hollywood talk.
Yeah. And to go back a mere 10 years, yeah. We're here at 120 Wall Street, approximately, yes. what, 7 or 8 blocks
right.
from the World Trade Center. And I had a show
mm-hmm.
about where there were where we are on Wall Street, there were trucks downstairs
yeah.
that acted as batteries. They uh-huh. were supplying electricity to this building so some offices in this building could work, including
right.
this one that we are in now. But I couldn't get the car to the area. I
yeah.
had to park north of Houston Street.
Right.
And I was about, you know, 45 minutes away from my show.
Mm-hmm.
How was I going to walk from Houston Street to here?
Yes.
Well, there were army vehicles
yeah.
going by with 20-year-olds flashing peace signs at me, you know, and like, and I stuck out a thumb for hitchhiking, and, you know, some army guys gave me a lift to uh-huh. yeah, where are you going? WBAI. Oh, far out.
Yeah.
And there was very little electricity in the area, mm-hmm. and a lot of this is about, what, 6 or 7 days after the whole place stunk.
Yeah. yeah.
Stunk of things I don't want to think about what they stunk of.
Yeah.
Again, the people helping people thing after 9/11
yeah.
Was amazing.
Do you remember the lines, long lines of people donating blood?
Yes. Yes. Absolutely. I remember the volunteers who were like Dunkirk, running boats from Manhattan to New York, to the outer boroughs.
I remember the blood donations specifically because to me it seemed like it was more about people wanting to help being unable to
they
do
didn't
anything
know what
else.
To do,
yeah.
So they tried to do the first
right.
things they could.
But that's, you know, that's the point. It actually makes you, you know, you feel helpless if you can't do anything. Yeah,
it's and so actually a unifying experience.
Right, you look to see what you can do to help,
yeah.
as opposed to what you know.
Yeah,
the opposite.
So that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
And so your description of that story, which we should mention, is Welcome to the Greenhouse yeah. from OR Books, edited by Gordon Van Gelder. What makes it so interesting? So, by the way, with Amir, God help us, under 25 minutes left of the show, if you, the listeners, yeah. would like to call up and speak with Gordon Van Gelder, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And, you know, I don't think I have, no, I probably do have to mention, having you on the air is a very special thing. I don't know that not everybody listening realizes that you're sort of, I wouldn't say exactly a fabled name in the world of science fiction, but a very important one.
Yeah, I wouldn't call myself fabled.
No, not fabled necessarily. Not yet, anyway. But no, I take that back. Yeah, there are fables about you. I have little doubt of that. But as, you know, an editor at St. Martin's Press, as the editor of FNSF, as a historian and all that, and a person who has a lot of interest and writes some of the best rejection letters I have ever seen, and that's very real, by the way.
Yeah.
You have this reputation for being able to turn a story around very quickly and write rejection letters that show you read the darn thing.
Unfortunately, those days are I'd love to get back to that, those fast turnarounds.
Oh, I saw one within the last 2 weeks.
I'm
not from me.
Having a 4-year-old in the house now, it's so much harder to get real reading done.
Yeah, but you got to dedicate the book to her.
Yes.
So what is the do you have a first reader anymore?
Oh yeah.
Oh, okay, because I know it was John Joseph Adams for years.
No, since John, even before John moved out to California, Stephen Mazur took over most of the duties. Lisa Rogers does some of the first reading also.
Mm-hmm. But, but how many stories do you read a month?
Oh, I don't even try to count.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah, but it
stacks.
Just in the last few months, I haven't been able to keep up. And I know today I got a letter from someone saying, I sent my story in December. How come I haven't heard back yet? And I looked, and it's there in the pile.
Yeah. Yeah.
So those fast turnarounds are just...
Yeah,
I long for them again.
Yeah, I know, but you know, God help us, Gavin and Kelly
Small Beer.
Small Beer. I keep thinking Jelly Ink, but which is another one of their imprints. Mm-hmm. But Small Beer Press. I mean, they have a lead time at this point. If they buy a story of yours, it's like 2.5 years or something like that. So they don't have a quick turnabout, and they got twins.
No, not. Just one daughter.
Just one daughter.
But she's got special needs.
Yeah, they have. There have been a lot of issues there. Yeah. So Jedediah Barry, of course, has been doing a bang up job of helping out. But yeah, they have special needs, exactly. And good morning. This is WBAI. You're on the air.
Yeah, okay.
Hello. Oh, you might want to turn down your radio. The delay gets confusing.
Yeah.
Hi there.
Hi. Well, you know, look, I appreciate the evening. I'm enjoying and listening to an editor of a major magazine, you know, especially in terms of publishing fiction. You know, I'd like more information about the magazine. I know you're publishing the book, but like the magazine is called what? The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction?
Yes, that's right. The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. If you're on the web, the website is fandsf.com.
F-A-N-D?
Yep.
As in F and S-F.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, now... And you're published out of New York City. You own it.
Yes, actually, we publish out of Jersey, Hoboken.
Hoboken. And did I understand you own the magazine? You bought it.
Yep.
Oh, cool. Now I don't want to ask you how much it costs, but I would like to know. But I know it might be a private matter. But you know, you were wondering like how much magazines cost these days.
It was. I'll put it this way. It was. Think of it as buying. It costs less than a Hoboken condo. But it was comparable to buying real estate.
Wow, that's interesting. That's interesting. And when you bought it, you bought all the back issues, which go back how far?
To 1949.
Gee, that's a great deal. Are you kidding? Wow, they sold your intellectual property for a few $100,000.
The intellectual property we bought is limited. Oh. You know, I mean, we published Stephen King. We published Flowers for Algernon. We have a long history, but that doesn't mean we have the rights to go back and reprint all of those stories now.
Oh, it doesn't.
Rights sometimes revert to authors in some cases.
And in a lot of cases, it's very complicated. You know, we could go back and reprint one of those issues if we want to.
Right.
But if we want to go back and reprint a single story from that issue, we don't have those rights.
Well, it might be worth it to publish a whole issue just to publish a single story from an issue, right?
In a few cases, it might be. We haven't done it yet, but we might.
Well, you have to option that. That's exciting, actually. That's exciting. Now, and so you have a staff, you have offices, and you're able to actually make a living. Like, how many units do you move, and how is that? You know, I mean, of course, you don't have to answer. You can
as a rough number, about 25,000 units for each issue.
Which is quarterly or weekly?
Bi-monthly, 6 issues a year now.
This is exciting, and you're able to make a profit with those numbers, right?
I'm hesitating because generally, yes, we usually make a profit. In 2008 and 2009, though, you shouldn't have asked me that question.
Oh, no.
it was a rough stretch.
Uh-huh. But now, are you doing e-stuff now?
Excuse me?
Are you doing electronic publishing as well,
Yes, we do put out an electronic edition also. We've been had an electronic edition for 10 years.
For 10 years?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're way out ahead. And, you know, I noticed the Times has changed, and now their e-books and print books are being judged the same in terms of the sales, you know. So that's kind of a new thing, but you've been ahead of the curve on that one, huh?
We tried, but... there are a lot of people who say we're behind the curve. The curve moves every day.
Wow.
Yeah, and part of the problem, of course, is always figuring out not only what's in the curve, but what's going to stay there.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, what in that curve you can, you know, there's no reason you can't put out, oh, say, a PDF file or something like that. But will that be profitable? Right. Will that still exist in a year? Right. What about that audio edition?
Yeah.
You're never sure.
True, but you're generating that. That's a one-time course, right? And then you just have to keep it up there once you have
it. Well, it varies. For instance, we did do an audio edition a few years ago, and it lost a lot of money. We tried it again this year, and it didn't lose a lot of money. It lost a little money, and we probably could have kept going and broken even on it, but then other issues came up, and we haven't gotten back to it. And other issues largely involving rights and intellectual property and some things I don't want to get into just now.
Right. This is an audio edition or audio collection?
It was it was an audio edition, but it was only four stories out of one issue.
Excerpts from one issue,
yeah.
Oh, well, and you can only can keep that in print or keep it circulating for a certain amount of time?
No, it we can keep it going for, I think, indefinitely.
Wow.
At least for several years, anyway.
Well, what will stop you? I mean, once you've already done all the work on it, all you have to do is reproduce.
Economics.
Well, and limitations on the rights.
Oh, so there are limitations on the rights that the agents put forth, or the authors, or
typically the authors in our contracts, yeah.
Well, you know, this Italian guy gave me this contract recently. It was in perpetuity throughout the universe.
In perpetuity throughout the universe for technologies not yet known. No, I'm serious, because I was a writer of nonfiction for a number of years, working for, I worked for several major technology magazines, and I also worked for one of the very first online journals, going back to CompuServe, way, way back. And there were contracts that the people I was working for put out that mentioned technologies not yet invented.
Wow.
They were trying to buy those rights. They did buy those rights, actually.
Well, and you sold them, I assume, for a good price, right?
yeah, but since they were actually nonfiction articles about technology, and the fact of the matter is that in 5 years, nobody would be interested in those articles anyway. Well, but you know, who wants to read a review today of Word for DOS?
On this planet, maybe, but, you know.
Well, yeah, but you know, as I say, software reviews of no longer existing programs have a very limited attention.
This is funny. Now you have a, you've been, so you have, there's a subscription that you can buy to science fiction.
That's right, $34.97 for 1 year, yep.
I think I'm going to do that. I want to give it as a gift, you know. In fact, I'd like to have all the existing magazines.
Oh, that's, you should have talked to our board member who found them all on Park Slope, yeah.
Oh, did you have a premium of that?
No, he found them on a street.
Oh, no, I'm talking about just, you know.
If you do look on our website, we do have a back issues page, which shows all the available ones.
No, I just want to, I'm going to give a gift certificate subscription of the current issues starting forward. Now, do you publish fantasy as well as science?
Oh, yes.
You say you do.
Yep.
Now, do you do the kind of the Dungeons and Dragons, swords and sorcerer type stuff?
We try to mix it up uh-huh. with a whole variety of different sorts of fantasy and science fiction. Huh. The hardest part, honestly, is trying to balance it all. It always seems like we get more of one kind than another kind, and it's tough to keep readers who like horror, readers who like fantasy, and readers who like science fiction. It's tough to keep them all happy. I can't do it in any one issue.
And then is it urban fantasy? Is it sword and sorcery?
Oh.
You get into, is it cyberpunk? There are so many sub genres.
So you get an overabundance of one as opposed to another, and it's hard to balance, you say?
That's a big challenge in editing the magazine,
I guess the vampire thing is now. Because I kind of have an interest in sword and sorcery types of, alternative universe type stuff. So I'm wondering if you have any of that in your issues, and you're saying you do.
Yes, we do.
Oh, great. Well, I'm really enjoying this, you know, and I know you're pushing this new book on climate change. I just heard this guy come on who just was so negative to science change yesterday on Coast to Coast. Really surprising to me that this guy was so negative, but he wouldn't say why.
Yeah, I tell people I do a science fiction show, and they say, oh, like Coast to Coast? No.
No,
it doesn't ring a bell with me.
No, you do a real one. And by the way, Richard Lupoff, I used to hear that show on KPFA. It was a good show. It was
really?
It had, I think, two or three or four voices going at the same time. But it was a good show. Those guys were solid guys. And hopefully PPS has those tapes. But I'm sure, Michael Yoshida would have.
Pacifica Archives now. You're showing your age. PPS, I mean, it changed it from Pacifica Programming Services to Pacifica Archives like, 10 or 12 years ago. It is PPS as far as I'm concerned.
Right, I will always call it PPS.
Yeah, actually, so will I.
Hey, thanks a lot. Great show, man. I'm enjoying
Thank
it.
You so much. Take care. Bye-bye. Good call. Thank you so much for calling in. Good morning, Lister.
Morning.
Yeah, you see how subtle I am? Okay. Burn Baby Burn Clappers will be on your airwaves in just 11 minutes. Good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, Jim Frank.
Good morning, Bobson.
Oh, good. This is Bobson from Bulgaria. It's an honor to be able to speak with Gordon Van Gelder.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Bulgaria.
No, it's 15 minutes to 10 in the a.m.
Okay. Oh, okay. Good morning. I always get that wrong.
We're only 7 hours in the future.
Okay.
So I've been a subscriber to FNSF since the mid-1990s, and lately I renewed from Bulgaria, and I've been enjoying the editorials that you put out whenever you manage to, not too often.
No.
And also I want to mention I've been happy to have to deal with Andrew Grossman when problems arose during my subscription, and I just wanted to mention him.
I'll thank him in the office.
Okay.
But the editorials... go ahead. Sorry.
I was wondering how the turning from monthly magazine to six bimonthly career is turning out so far.
I remember
not being too happy when I found out, but now I've gotten used to it, and it's thicker, for one thing. And
right, and the issues last longer. It's worked out pretty well overall. There were a few people like you who initially resisted it.
I was one of them.
A subscriber then, so it's not that I resisted it. I was a bit apprehensive, but when I
felt
saw
like
it,
you were getting
like,
half the issues, right. Yeah.
No. But the page count was still there. Six of the double issues that only came out once a year before that, so you used to have a double October, November.
Right, just one double a year. The transition's gone pretty well overall. I'm very happy in that most readers have stuck with us and have not sent in. We haven't gotten massive numbers of complaints. Honestly, the only people I noticed who canceled at the time we switched were the incarcerated subscribers, people in jail.
Interesting.
Who felt like they specifically signed up because they wanted an issue every month because they needed something to read. And they didn't want to wait too much.
Do you know if this was every individual subscriber, or might there have been some issues in terms of how the prisons are run?
Right.
Or?
No, these were individuals.
Interesting.
Yeah, not the libraries necessarily.
Another thing I was wondering about the electronic editions. Last year I tried out the publisher who does that for you and Asimov's and Analog because the magazines were late, and I decided to see how the electronic issues are, and I got an electronic reader, and I paid for the permission of that electronic outfit who does that to look at their files, and I was unhappy with what I got, and I was wondering if you have considered bringing it in-house for future at some point, maybe.
Well, just this week I got signed contracts for a new deal for an electronic edition, and I don't want to say too much about it just yet.
Another another
yes,
company doing it, then so forth. Oh, that sounds like a good idea because I was... Another thing, there are magazines now that I know of, American magazines, who provide access to the electronic magazine to subscribers of the print copies or, you know, just for the subscribers of the paper stuff.
Yeah, I mean, for example, The New Yorker does that.
Right.
If you are a subscriber to The New Yorker, you get access to every issue ever published, and you can access it online.
Also, you talked to a previous caller that you obtained rights to reprint issues in their entirety. And I remember maybe in the mid-1990s, I saw in a library DVDs of National Geographic, mm-hmm. which were scanned, the magazines were scanned and put out on DVD for their entire run, and it was something that I wanted to see from SNSF and Asimov and Analog, and there were rights issues as well, but something like that might be a good project.
It's a big project. It's something that we wanted to do.
It would be,
if we do, if we scan one issue a month, you know, we could get the job done in about 60 years.
The access to well.
Seriously, I do hope and intend to have the complete run on scanned in an electronic format eventually.
I've seen some of the early Astounding magazines from the late 1920s on archive.org already. So something like that.
Because those have gone public domain, and so it's just readers and fans who've been doing the scanning.
Yeah.
Okay, I guess it's a big project, but it would be...
It would be lovely. I'd pay to own that.
I speak with the company about doing it last year and about what it would involve to get all the scans done, and we both agreed we're going to do this eventually, but we just don't have the resources together right now.
Yeah, okay.
By the way, we have under 1 minute left before I have to go off the air.
Okay.
I wanted to say I enjoyed the 60th anniversary issues, and I was wondering what it was that you asked on the forums about songs of science fiction. And you two mentioned the movie Demons with Sharp Teeth, and I was wondering if it was Dreams with Sharp Teeth.
Yes.
Sorry, Dreams with Sharp Teeth.
Okay.
I had a demon in me saying that.
And
25 seconds.
I wanted to ask Jim if he's seen the new books of stories by Philip K. Dick that recently came out with volume 1 of 5. It was one of the small presses. And,
Subterranean.
No, I've not yet seen it.
Morning.
I have the complete already, so it seems redundant.
Well, yeah.
It's well worth it.
They say there's new stories in these 5 volumes, but I never know. I wouldn't know.
Yeah, well, you never know what might have been unearthed. We are past due on our time. I've actually started silently in the background my outro.
You have a great morning, you two, and it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Likewise.
Pleasure talking with you.
Take care. Good morning. Okay, so let's recap a few things. The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction on newsstands, available for subscription. Yes.
And fine bookstores everywhere.
And fine bookstores, mortar or otherwise.
Yes.
Also available at fandsf.com.
That's correct.
At OR Books, the publisher, or orbooks.com is Welcome to the Greenhouse.
And that you really have to go to the website to find it. It's only in 1 or 2 bookstores. I think St. Mark's bookstore.
Yeah, but
is carrying
it's a wonderful collection.
But
it's a lovely looking website, especially for BAI style listeners.
So if you're
we have a number of alumni who have books there.
Yes.
And Wednesday, the reading series that Gordon Van Gelder did not begin, the KGB Fantastic Fiction reading series, Genevieve Valentine and Carolyn Turgeon will be the readers. So more information on that, go to kgbfantasticfiction.org, and I'll see you there. And I'll be on the air, just a few hours after that reading is over. With what? I don't know. Maybe I can con somebody out of the reading. Maybe I'll finally broadcast that Connie Willis interview that I've got burning a hole in my pocket. That would be a good thing to play. Gordon, I can't thank you enough for being here.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise. And you know, I wish we had more time, but we are out of it. Yep. But that also means that Burn Baby Burn Clappers is coming your way in just moments. So do stay tuned. And, oh my God, why instead of fading up my outro, I was fading up my intro. Dear, dear, dear. So, I am sorry, Lister, but I have to just put it in a... Well, I know that you know how to skillfully segue. You're going to need to do that because I screwed it up. So thank you again all for listening. Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, Jim. Builder.
And we'll be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. Stay tuned. Good morning.
Inferno,
burn, baby, burn.
Turn that mother out.
Fire.
This will
Tangier in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM. WBAI, 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. 5 minutes after 3 o'clock right here at 99. Cinco Listo Live, Burn Baby Burn on the Thursday. Where your Thursday is a Friday, where your Thursday is a Saturday, where your Thursday is a Sunday. Where we kick it off with this right here at 99 Cinco. 212-209-2900. Yeah. The Pulse. The Pulse. Says the most oppressed music in the history of the United States of America, imperialist America. They fight this reggae music like no tomorrow. Listen why. In a place called Wisconsin. Ya listen. Yo. Globalizing protest right here at 99 Cinco. Ya listen, man. Walk like an Egyptian, fight like a Libyan. Wisconsin. We can win this in such a way we don't go back to this madness, y'all. Reggae music. No choice. Jama Weezy, Jama Weezy, Jama Weezy. With a big head spliff. With some ganja, yeah. Y'all listen to me. Get political or die, y'all. 99 Cinco, we had no choice but to call the show Burn Baby Burn, where we burn the imperialist American old flag to ashes before 5 o'clock. Nine Cinco, Apte Selassie. Every time I play Steel Pulse, Apte Selassie gets this tingling feeling, gets goosebumps, you know what I mean? Yeah. Right here at 99 Cinco, so we do it, you know. 212-209-2900, David Katz in Trinidad with Claudia. This is for both of you. Yo, still fetting in Trinidad after Big Ass Carnival, yeah. So we do it TNT style, Tobago style. 212-209-2950. Talk to me, tell me something that I should be on the case about, y'all. Yeah, yeah. George Galloway comes to town. You ready for that? 99 Cinco. Yeah, yeah. Deep in the heart of a place called Cairo, where male chauvinism seems to still live. 1,000 women showed up bravely, celebrating International Women's Day, still celebrating it right here on the tip, Burn Baby Burn style. It's so ironic in Egypt, at the forefront of the uprising were women at the vanguard. Yet, when it comes to equality between woman and man, why is it still a problem? Baba Vakin, get on the case. We need some solutions.